9. At a signal from Morris, a servant approached Parsons. Bowing formally, the servant set down an object at Parsons' feet. He recognized it at once. Dented, stained, it was still familiar. His gray instrument case. "We were not able to get you," Helmar said. "But we managed to pick this up, in the hotel lobby. During the confusion after the government understood that the girl would recover." With tension, they watched as he opened the instrument case and began inspecting the contents. "We examined those instruments," Loris said, from over his shoulder. "But none of our technicians could make use of them. Our orientation does not equip us. We lack the basic principles. If you don't have all you need, we can supply you with other medical material, which we dredged from the past. Originally, we imagined that if we had the material, we could make use of it ourselves."
Parsons said, "How long has this man been in the cube?"
"He has been dead 35 years, Loris said matter-of-factly.
Parsons said, "I'll know more once I've been able to examine him. Can he be brought out of the cold pack?"
"Yes," Helmar said. "For no more than half an hour at a time, however."
"That should be enough," Parsons said.
Almost together, Helmar and Loris said, "Then you'll do it?"
"I'll try," he answered.
A wave of relief ran between the two of them, relaxing. They smiled at him. The tension in the room waned.
"Is there any reason," Parsons said, "why you can't tell me your relation to this man?" He faced Loris squarely. After a pause, she said,
"He's my father."
For a moment, the significance did not register. And then he thought, "But how can she know?"
Loris said, "I prefer not to tell you any more. At least, not now. Later."
She seemed tired out by the situation.
"Let me have a servant show you to your apartment, and then perhaps we can..."
She glanced at the man in the cube.
"Perhaps you could begin your examination of him."
"I'd like to get some rest first," Parsons said. "After a good night's sleep, I'd be in better shape."
Their disappointment showed clearly, but immediately Loris nodded and then, more reluctantly, Helmar. "Of course," she said.
A servant came to show him to his apartment. Carrying Parsons' gray case, the servant preceded him up a wide flight of stairs. The man glanced back once, but said nothing. In silence, they reached the apartment. The servant held the door open for Parsons, and he entered.
What luxury, he thought. Beyond doubt, he was the honored guest of the lodge,
and with good reason. At dinner that night, he learned, from Loris and Helmar, the physical layout of their lodge. They were slightly over 20 miles from the city, which he had first encountered, the capital, at which the Soul Cube and Fountain were located. Here in the lodge, Loris, as the Mother Superior, lived with her entourage, like some great opulent queen bee, Parsons thought. In this busy hive, beyond that area controlled by the government, this was sacred land. The lodge, like a Roman domain, was self-contained, independent economically and physically. Underneath the buildings were giant power turbines, atomic generators a century old. He had briefly glimpsed the subterranean landscape of drivetrains and whirring spheres, in some cases rust-covered masses of machines that still managed to roar and throb. But as he had tried to penetrate further, he had been firmly turned back by armed uniformed guards, youths wearing the familiar wolf emblem. Food was grown artificially in subsurface chemical tanks. Clothing and furniture were processed from plastic raw materials by robots working somewhere on the grounds. Building materials, industrial supplies, everything that was needed, was manufactured and repaired on the lodge grounds. A complete world, the core of which, like the city, was the cube, the miniature soul with which he would soon be working. He didn't have to be told how carefully the secret of its existence was kept. Probably only a few persons knew of it, probably not more than a fraction of those living and working at the lodge. And how many of them understood its purpose, the reason for its existence? Perhaps only Loris and Helmar knew, As they sat at the table, sipping after-dinner coffee and brandy, he asked Helmar bluntly, "Are you related to Loris?"
"Why do you ask?" Helmar said.
"You resemble the man in the cube, her father, and you resemble her faintly." Helmar shook his head.
"No relation."
His earlier excitement and eagerness now seemed masked over by politeness, and yet Parsons felt it still there, still smoldering. There were so many things that Parsons did not understand. Too much, he decided, was being kept back. He had accepted the obvious. Loris and Helmar were acting illegally. Had been for some time. The very possession of the miniature cube was clearly a crime of the first magnitude. The maintenance of the body, the attempt to restore it to life, all were part of a painstakingly guarded and constructed plan of which the government and certainly the other tribes knew nothing. He could understand Loris's desire to see her father alive. It was a natural emotion, common possibly to all societies, including his own. He could understand the elaborate lengths she had gone to in attempting to realize that wish. With her great influence and power, it might actually be possible to do this, as contrary as it was to everything the society stood for. After all, the man had been preserved uncorrupted for all of Loris's lifetime. The cube, the complex maintenance equipment, the whole lodge itself was geared to this task. The development and use of the time dredge, no doubt. If so much had already been done, the rest might follow. But out of all this, one element still made no sense. In this society, all zygotes were developed and preserved by the fountain, a purely artificial process. Parsons chose his words carefully. "This man," he said to Loris, "your father, was he born at the fountain?" Both she and Helmar regarded him with equal caution.
"No one is born outside the fountain," Loris said in a low voice.
Helmar, with impatience, said, "What does such information have to do with your work? We have complete data on his physical condition at the time of his death. It's his death that's germane to you, not his birth."
"Who built the cube?" Parsons demanded bluntly.
"Why?" Loris said, almost inaudibly. She glanced at Helmar. "The design," Helmar explained slowly, "is the same as the fountain the government operates. No special knowledge was required to duplicate on a small scale what the government operates on a large scale."
"Somebody brought schematics here and constructed all this," Parsons persisted,
"obviously at great risk and for considerable purpose."
Loris said, "To preserve him, my father."
At once Parsons pounced. He felt his pulse race. "Then the cube was built after his death?" Neither of them answered.
"I don't see," Loris said finally, "what this has to do with your work, as Helmar says."
"I'm a hired employee then?" Parsons said. "Not a genuine equal who can communicate with you as equals?"
Helmar glared at him, but Loris seemed more troubled than angry. Falteringly, she said,
"No, not at all. It's just that the risk is so great, and it actually doesn't concern you, does it? Why should it, doctor? When you treat a patient, a person who's sick or injured, do you inquire into his background, his beliefs, his purpose in life, his philosophy?"
"No," he admitted.
"We'll repay you," Loris said. "We can place you in any time period that you desire."
Across the table from him, she smiled hopefully, coaxingly. But Parsons said, "I have a wife whom I love. All I want to do is get back to her."
"That's so," Helmar said. "We noticed her while we were out scouting you."
"And knowing that," Parsons said, "you still brought me here without my knowledge or permission. I gather that my personal feelings are of no concern to you." He hesitated. "In your estimation, I'm no better than a slave."
"That's not true,"
Loris said, and he saw tears in her eyes.
"You don't have to help us. You can go back to your own time if you want. It's your choice."
Suddenly, she rose from the table.
"Excuse me,"
she said in a choked voice, and ran at once from the room. Presently, Helmar said, "You can sympathize with her feelings." He sat stoically sipping his coffee. "There's never been any chance before your coming. Let's acknowledge that you don't particularly care for me, but that's not the issue. You're not doing this for me. You're doing it for her." The man had a point there. And yet, even Loris had hung back, had not given him honest answers. The whole atmosphere was pervaded with this sense of the hidden, the concealed. Why from him? If they trusted him enough to show him the man in the cube, to reveal the cube itself, then what more could there be? Did they suppose that if he knew more about them, he would not cooperate? He filed his suspicions away and sat, like Helmar, sipping his coffee royal. Unobtrusively, servants came and departed. Neither he nor Helmar said anything. They sipped in silence. The brandy was very good, an authentic cognac. At last, Helmar put down his cup and stood up.
"Ready, doctor," he said, "to make your initial exploratory examination?"
Parsons, too, stood.
"Yes," he said. "Let's go."